near the end of my research, and actually near the end of my book, I go to the sea. Our impact on the land, of course, only deals with one third of the planet, and I didn't want to overlook the rest of it. And I was fortunate enough to join the Scripps Oceanographic Expedition that went out to the South Sea Islands to look at the most pristine coral reefs remaining farthest away from human impact to see what a baseline might be for a healthy coral reef system. And, of course, there's lots of variables, global warming, all kinds of things are affecting the oceans, and we saw some stunning things. We saw some close to pristine environments. There were still huge predators swimming out there, lots of sharks and big snappers, and it was pretty extraordinary. But we did see the impact of bleaching of the corals, and we saw things like plastic that would be heaped up on the reefs that came across on the Japanese current, and no matter how fast you clean it away, more would come. I was fortunate enough to be around all these geniuses. It was an international expedition from all these different countries, people who were specialists in ichthyology, big sharks, all the way down to microbes and vegetation. And I had them all to myself for about 3 weeks. It was just, you know, a journalist couldn't ask for more. It was just thrilling. I remember one evening talking to Jeremy Jackson, a paleoecologist, about some of the really horrible things that have been hammering the sea, and the fact that so many of the coral reefs of the Caribbean that he studied for so long have turned to slime. And he said, yeah, you know, the great thing about the sea is that as badly as we've overfished it, as much as it's been hammered by us, the ecosystem, to a great extent, is still intact. Very few species are actually extinct, and given a chance, things could come back to the way they were if we just gave them some room. And he would talk about how when Columbus came across the Caribbean on his third voyage, his galleon almost had to act like an icebreaker going just through fields of sea turtles, and how the sharks would be so big and plentiful that they would swim right up the rivers to prey on the cattle that they had introduced. And he said, you know, ultimately, the life keeps springing back from the sea, and it will spring back again. And even if we have altered the climate, well, change is not an exception. Change is the norm in nature. Things always change. Maybe the coral reefs will move farther north, but the sea is resilient, and life will spring anew. Well, I mention that right now because traveling around the country since this book has come out, I'm acutely aware that we once lived in a much richer literary ecosystem than we do now, that there used to be in every community fabulous independent bookstores that reflected those communities or little facets of those communities. And sadly enough, a lot of that has been beaten back by the activities of humans, and we only have a few little examples here and there, but they're not extinct, and possibly the most robust example of them all in our entire nation is the one that we're in today. I am so grateful for the existence of Powell's. May it prosper, and may its reflection spread across our land anew someday. Well, for the past 20 years, I have had the privilege to be covering the most important story on Earth, which is to say the Earth itself. It's taken me to a lot of magnificent places, and also to some frightening ones, and oftentimes they're the same. I've been to Antarctica, and I've looked up into its ozone hole. The Amazon and the fires and the saw blades that are bringing it down, and the steppes and the rivers of Ukraine, incredible topsoil 1,000 feet deep, and some of the Chernobyl nuclear plant that has contaminated so much of it. The frozen Arctic that is now the thawing Arctic. The more that I've seen and the more that I've learned, the more important my job has become and the job of science writers everywhere, because it's increasingly clear that we have to really understand what's happening before it's too late. I mean, for the planet, possibly for us. But the more important it becomes, the harder the job also becomes, because at a certain point, this stuff becomes so overwhelming, it becomes frankly depressing or even scary, and who the hell wants to read it? I mean, I oftentimes don't. It takes an effort to look at some of this stuff. So for quite a while, I have been searching for a way to bring this story, the complete story of how all these things that I've seen connect and intersect around us, without pulling any punches, without minimizing or trivializing or sugarcoating what's going on. I wanted to find some kind of approach that would make people keep reading, that they wouldn't want to just throw the book away, that they would stop worrying about, oh my God, are we all going to die? And just keep turning the pages to see, you know, what happens next, and maybe to find an idea of what we ought to do next. Well, here's what I came up with. I came up with a little experiment, creative experiment. Let's try it. Suppose the worst has happened. Human extinctions, fait accompli, and not by nuclear calamity or asteroid collision or anything ruinous enough to also wipe out most everything else, leaving whatever remained in some radically altered or reduced state, nor by some grim eco-scenario in which we agonizingly fade, dragging many more species with us in the process. Instead, picture a world from which we all just suddenly vanished, like tomorrow. Unlikely, but for the sake of argument, it's not impossible. Let's say a Homo sapiens-specific virus, naturally or diabolically nano-engineered, picks us off but leaves everything else intact. Or some misanthropic evil genius somehow targets that unique 3.9% of DNA that makes us human beings and not chimpanzees. Or perfects a way to sterilize our sperm. Or say that Jesus or space aliens rapture us away, either to our heavenly glory or to a zoo somewhere across the galaxy. Look around you. Look at today's world, your house, your city. The surrounding land, the pavement underneath, the soil hidden below that. Leave it all in place, but extract the human beings. Wipe us out and see what's left. How would the rest of nature respond if it were suddenly relieved of the relentless pressures we heap on it and our fellow organisms? How soon would or could the climate return to where it was before we fired up all our engines? How long would it take to recover lost ground and restore Eden to the way it must have gleamed and smelled the day before Adam or the predecessors of Homo sapiens first appeared? Could nature ever obliterate all our traces? How would it undo our monumental cities and our public works, reduce our myriad plastics and toxic synthetics back to benign basic elements? Or are some so unnatural that they're indestructible? And what of our finest creations? Our architecture, our art, our many manifestations of spirit, are any truly timeless, at least enough so to last until the sun expands and roasts the earth to a cinder? And even after that, might we have left some faint, enduring mark on the universe, some lasting glow or echo of earthly humanity, some interplanetary sign that once we were here? Well, for a sense of how the world will go on beyond us, among other places, we must look at the world before us. We're not time travelers, and that fossil record's only a fragmentary sampling. But even if that record were complete, the future wouldn't perfectly mirror the past, because we've ground some species so thoroughly into extinction that they or their DNA will likely never spring back. Some things that we've done are likely irrevocable. So what would remain in our absence would not be the same planet had we never evolved in the first place. And it might not be so different either. Nature's been through worse losses before, and it's refilled empty niches. And even today, there are still a few earthly spots where all our senses can inhale a living memory of this Eden before we were here. Inevitably, they invite us to wonder how nature might flourish if granted the chance. Well, since we're imagining, why not also dream of a way for nature to prosper that doesn't depend on our demise? We are, after all, mammals ourselves. Every life form adds to this vast pageant. And with our passing, might some lost contribution of ours leave the planet a bit more impoverished? Is it possible that instead of heaving a huge biological sigh of relief, that the world without us would miss us? Well, thus begins my book, The World Without Us. I start it, after that introduction, in a few places that are familiar to readers, except that I learned in my research that what is familiar can be surprising. For instance, you may never have heard of the Bialowaisa Pusha, but if you were raised somewhere in the temperate swath that crosses much of North America, or Japan, Korea, Russia, several former Soviet republics, parts of China, Turkey, Eastern, Western Europe, including the British Isles, something within you remembers it. Pusha, it's an old Polish word, means forest primeval. Straddling the border between Poland and Belarus, the 500,000 acres of the Bialowaisa Pusha contain Europe's last remaining fragment of old-growth lowland wilderness. Think of the misty, brooding forest that loomed behind your eyelids when, as a child, someone read you the Grimm Brothers' fairy tales. Here, ash and linden trees tower nearly 150 feet, and their huge canopies shade a moist, tangled understory of hornbeams, ferns, swamp alders, crockery-sized fungi. Oaks, shrouded with a half a millennium's worth of moss, grow so immense that the great spotted woodpeckers can store spruce cones in their 3-inch-deep oak bark furrows. The air is thick and cool, and it's draped with a silence that just parts only briefly for a nutcracker's croak or a pygmy owl's whistle or a wolf's wail. Then it returns to this thick stillness. The fragrance that wafts from eons of accumulated mulch in the forest core harken to fertility's very origins. In the Bialowaisa, the profusion of life owes much to all that's already dead. So almost a quarter of the organic mass above ground is in assorted stages of decay, decomposing trunks and fallen branches on every acre, nourishing thousands of species of mushrooms, lichens, bark beetles, grubs, microbes, many of which are missing from the orderly managed woodlands that pass as forests elsewhere. Together, those species stock a sylvan larder that provides for weasels and pine martens, raccoons, badgers, otters, foxes, lynx, wolves, roe deer, elk, eagles, and even bison, European bison. More kinds of life are found here than anywhere else on the continent, and yet there are no surrounding mountains or sheltering valleys to form unique niches for endemic species. The Bialowaisa Pusha is simply a relic of what once stretched from Siberia west to Ireland. Now, the existence in Europe of such a legacy of unbroken biological antiquity owes to, unsurprisingly, high privilege. During the 14th century, a Lithuanian duke, having successfully allied his Grand Duchy with the Kingdom of Poland by marrying the queen, declared the forest a royal hunting preserve, and for centuries it stayed that way. When the Polish-Lithuanian Union was finally subsumed by Russia, the Bialowaisa became the private domain of the Tsars. And although occupying Germans took lumber and slaughtered game during World War I, a pristine core was left intact, and which in 1921 became a Polish national park. The pillaging of timber resumed briefly under the Soviets, but when the Nazis invaded, a nature fanatic named Hermann Göring decreed the entire preserve off limits, except by his pleasure. Following World War II, a reportedly drunken Joseph Stalin agreed one evening in Warsaw to let Poland retain 2/5 of the forest. And little changed under communist rule, except for the construction of some elite hunting dachas, in one of which an agreement was signed in 1991 dissolving the Soviet Union into free states. Well, what's startling is to think that all Europe once looked just like this place. To enter it is to realize that most of us were bred to a pale copy of what nature intended. Seeing elders with trunks 7 feet wide or walking through stands of the tallest trees here, which are these gigantic Norway spruce, as shaggy as Methuselah, should seem as exotic as the Amazon or Antarctica to someone who was raised among the comparatively puny second-growth woodlands found throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Yet, what's astonishing is how primally familiar it feels, and on some cellular level, how complete. Our bodies remember the world when it was fresh. You know, the initial reaction of most of the people, probably 90% of the people, I would tell when they would ask me what I was working on, you know, that I was writing a book about the world without people, was to blurt out, "Oh God, that sounds so great." And, you know, I think that we do have some genetic memory of when things were more complete. Well, later, of course, those same people would then wistfully reflect that, yeah, but wouldn't it be such a shame, though, that if to bring nature back to full flower meant that humans had to go? Because, after all, we've also created our share of incredible beauty on this planet, which I agreed to, and I absolutely agree. So before this book ends, you know, I linger over some of the wonderful things that we have done, and I suggest how maybe we might actually get to stick around and be part of nature restored to harmony. But first, you know, how is it that we got so walled off from the earth that we actually lost touch with it? And what would happen if those walls suddenly vanished? So let me just give you a couple little tastes here. On the day after humans disappear, nature takes over and immediately begins cleaning house, or houses, that is. It cleans them right off the face of the earth, and they all go. Now, if you're a homeowner, you already knew that it was a matter of time for yours, but you've resisted admitting it even as erosion callously attacks, starting with your savings. Back when they told you what your house would cost, nobody mentioned what you'd also be paying so that nature wouldn't repossess it long before the bank. Now, even if you live in a denatured postmodern subdivision where heavy machines mash the landscape into submission, replacing unruly native flora with obedient sod and uniform saplings, paving wetlands in the righteous name of mosquito control, even then you know that nature wasn't fazed. No matter how hermetically you've sealed your temperature-tuned interior from the weather, invisible spores penetrate anyway, exploding in sudden outbursts of mold, which is awful when you see it, and it's even worse when you don't, because it's hidden behind a painted wall and it's munching paper sandwiches of gypsum board and rotting studs and floor joists. Or you've been colonized by termites or carpenter ants, roaches, hornets, small mammals. But most of all, though, you are beset by, in what other context, is the veritable stuff of life, water, because it always wants in. So after we're gone, nature's revenge for our smug mechanized superiority arrives waterborne. It starts with wood frame construction, the most widely used residential building technique in the developed world, beginning on the roof, which is probably asphalt or slate shingle, and it's warranted to last 2 or 3 decades. But that warranty doesn't count around the chimney, where the first leak occurs. Or if you have skylights, you know already of what I speak. As the flashing separates under rain's relentless insistence, water sneaks beneath the shingles, and it flows across 4x8 sheets of sheathing made either of plywood or, if newer, of wood chip board, which is composed of these 3 to 4 inch flakes of timber that are bonded together by a resin. Now, newer isn't necessarily better. Wernher von Braun, the German scientist who developed the U.S. space program, used to tell a story about Colonel John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth. Seconds before liftoff, with Glenn strapped into that rocket we built for him and man's best efforts all focused on that moment, you know what he said to himself? "Oh my God, I'm sitting on a pile of low bids." Well, in your new house, you've been sitting under one. And on the one hand, that's okay. By building things so cheaply and lightly, we use fewer of the world's resources. On the other hand, the massive trees that yielded the great wooden posts and beams that still support medieval European or early American walls are now too precious and rare, and we're left to make do with gluing together smaller boards and scraps. Well, the resin in your cost-conscious choice of wood chip roof, which is this waterproof goo of formaldehyde and phenol polymer, was also applied along the board's edges, but it fails anyway because moisture enters around the nails. Soon they're rusting and their grip begins to loosen. That presently leads not only to interior leaks, but to structural mayhem. Besides underlying the roofing, the wooden sheathing secures trusses to each other. Trusses, those pre-manufactured braces held together with metal connection plates, are there to keep the roof from splaying. But when the sheathing goes, structural integrity goes with it. You know, it just goes on and on until there's nothing but the chimney, and then the chimney starts falling apart. But time doesn't permit me to punish you homeowners with the rest of this right now. And also, some of you may be thinking, well, come on, a wood frame house is one thing, but what about our massive cities, our big steel and concrete, you know, enormous urban infrastructures? Could nature really, really reduce that to nothing and reclaim it? Which is exactly the question I asked when I went to the most recognizable city on earth, Manhattan, New York City. Everyone's either been there or they've seen it in the movies. And it's pretty imposing, as we all know. And I asked that very question of all kinds of people. You know, what could bring this thing down? And what would replace it? I was fortunate enough to find that the World Wildlife Conservation Society and Bronx Zoo has a project going called the Manhattan Project, which is modeling what the forest was like when Henry Hudson first saw it in 1609. There were only a few indigenous people living on the shores then, most of them just fishing. They weren't really touching the land very much. Manhattan, the word Manhattan, from which it's derived, meant hilly. There were all kinds of salt marshes and swamps, and there were about 40 streams running between those hills. And then they all got mashed down and pushed underground when we flattened the city and to superimpose a grid on top of it. Well, it still rains as much as it always did in New York, and what I was informed was that, again, water is going to be the vulnerable point that will start bringing down the city. It will start in the subway tunnels. Subway engineers took me through them to show me where that groundwater is now. The sewers, which are only imperfect mimics of what nature does, can only wick away so much. So there are about 13 million gallons, even on a sunny day, that come coursing out of the bedrock that they have to pump away. If human beings weren't there, not only would these guys not be manning the pumps and servicing them, but the power plants would go off pretty quickly. And the subways would fill with water. And everything metal underneath the ground would start to corrode. The most obvious things are those big columns that hold up the ceiling when you're standing on the subway platform, and that ceiling is actually the street. So as they start to corrode and buckle, the streets would cave in, and pretty soon, think of the 456 train, that one on the east side, pretty soon Lexington Avenue would be exposed and it would turn into a river again. And birds would start dropping things into it by mistake, little herrings, little clams. And before we know it, we'd have an ecosystem with frogs, if we still have frogs. Their echoes would be bouncing off of a lot of buildings that would be in a rapid state of deterioration for a couple of reasons. In a city, concrete doesn't last very long if it's not maintained, because you get these freeze-thaw cycles, particularly, you know, at the end of the winter. And every time a crack forms, snowmelt will rush in, and then it freezes again, and the crack widens, and then April blows in seeds, and the seeds start taking root, and the pavement starts cracking even more, and entire trees like ailanthus start sprouting rather quickly in New York. The buildings, the leak, we already know what happens on roofs, and as that water trickles down inside of a concrete facing, the rebar, the steel reinforcing bar, begins to rust, and it has to expand. And as it expands, it just starts popping off concrete facing. Meantime, plastic bags, an uncountable number of plastic bags, are filling the sewers, clogging them. Leaf litter is piling up because nobody's raking the leaves anymore. And pretty soon, leaves are rooting along the gutters, and then sooner or later, a lightning strike will ignite some tree or some building whose lightning rod has corroded, and fire will spread through office buildings. All that fax paper will go up, and paper insulation, all that will add nutrients to the soil. So we'll start seeing even more plants taking advantage of changing and improving soil. And when buildings start to topple, which civil engineers assured me they would, because even the great steel-reinforced concrete foundations in Manhattan that are anchored to the Manhattan schist, they were not meant to be waterlogged, and they will become more unstable. Hurricanes will finally topple one of those big guys, and you've seen what happens when a tree falls in the forest. It takes down a few others and creates a clearing, and that's exactly what will happen in the urban clearing, and plants will rush in out of Central Park and Gramercy Park, etc. Now, one thing that I wondered about was, okay, we can get a forest back, and it really will happen. There's lots of examples in my book in abandoned places, even in New York City, where it already has happened. But would it be at all the same temperate forest that was there? So I went to the New York Botanical Garden. They've got 40 acres of old-growth forest that's not doing very well because a lot of those trees are sick. Accumulations of industrial pollutants and automobile exhausts have weakened them. Opportunistic diseases or beetles have gone in there and eaten a lot of them. And a lot of opportunistic interlopers of ornamental plants that we have introduced everywhere. Humans have done this a lot faster than birds have ever done it. And they are taking foothold in the New York Botanical Garden. You got Japanese barberry and Oriental bittersweet, and of course the famous ailanthus tree that just, I mean, you can see them growing up in subway grates now. It turns out that, you know, the ecosystem will be sort of a human artifact that will persist in our absence, this botanical mix that would have never occurred without us. But a curator at New York Botanical Garden told me, he says, you know, that might not be so bad. I mean, just think of it. We consider New York a great city for its cultural diversity. Everyone has something to offer, but botanically, we're so xenophobic. We love native species and we want aggressive exotic plant species to go back home. You know, he said, this might seem blasphemous, but maintaining biodiversity is less important than maintaining a functioning ecosystem. What really matters is that soil is protected and that water gets cleaned and that trees filter the air, that a canopy regenerates new seedlings to keep nutrients from draining away into the Bronx River. And he goes on to talk to me about his own research, which has taken him to the so-called virgin Borneo, where you see these clumps of durian fruit trees, or the tea trees in Burma's jungle, or the nut trees in Brazil's Amazon. He says, those concentrations aren't accidents. Once humans were there too. The wilderness swallowed them in their memory, but the shape still bears their echo, as will this one. Well, after I dismantle New York City, I go on to look at what the world was like before us. It was a world filled with enormous creatures on all land masses. Coincidentally, they all disappeared around the same time that humans arrived. So I went to Africa, the place where they still exist, and then I had to ask the question, well, how come they're still here? And of course, the answer that ecologists give is that, well, humans and animals that exist today evolved together on that planet. And the animals evolved learning certain evasive techniques to not get entirely extinguished by this very clever, increasingly clever new predator. Which then raised the question for me, well, why did humans evolve here in the first place? And it's a discussion that's probably more than we can go into right now, but it was rather fascinating for me to finally go. I went into the forest where Jane Goodall has been studying chimpanzees and confront our brethren, those siblings of ours with whom we share a common ancestor, and try to look into their eyes and figure out, okay, why'd you all stay in the forest? Why did we leave? You know, and one answer that we like to think of is that we were the bigger brain, the intrepid risk takers, the ones who could see beyond the horizon. We had this vision and we kept going and we learned how to exist in the savannah, even though there were fierce predators out there. But the other one might be that, you know, the breach between chimpanzees and humans took place during a period of very active glaciation in the world. And even though Africa didn't get covered by ice, whenever so much moisture was locked up in the ice, Africa experienced a drought. The forests would shrink. And there may have been a battle royal going on in those forests to see who was going to keep the limited number of resources in there, who was going to get the best fruit trees, who got banished and kicked out. So maybe we were the losers. And we just crawled out of there, but we showed them, didn't we? Well, my book goes on to look at a variety of things to see what we have done on the planet, how we have showed them. It shows the strange irony that war zones sometimes are turns out to be one of the best things that happens to the ecosystem. In the Korean DMZ, I had the great privilege of looking at what has become one of the most important nature preserves in all of Asia, where some of the most splendid and most endangered creatures on the planet have sought refuge in this little 2.5 mile wide strip that runs 180 miles across the peninsula. It's like walking into a metaphor to be standing alongside one army. I was with the South Korean army, obviously, and with all these armaments and all these bunkers, these mortars and everything pointed across over there, and you can see the other ones pointed back, and these guys are looking at each other, and the hostilities are utterly seething. And in the midst of it float these flotillas of these incredible birds, the red-crowned crane, whose images you see in all the spiritual paintings of Japan, and it's considered a holy bird all over the Orient, Korea's national bird. And this thing, besides its cherry red cap and its black wingtips, it's just as white as innocence itself, and it floats down in the midst of all this human horror and settles down lightly enough to not touch off any landmines. And it partakes of the ecosystem that has replaced 5,000 years worth of rice paddies. It's really amazing to see that, and makes you wonder what would happen if there wasn't war. What would probably happen is that it would all be developed. The mines would be swept away, and the suburbs of Seoul would sneak in there, and thus industrial parks of North Korea, unless as some ecologists worldwide are trying to convince both those governments to unite and to show the world that they could do something wonderful together by creating an international peace park, which E.O. Wilson told me would be, man, just think of it. It's like Yellowstone and Gettysburg rolled in one. They've got to be able to make enough money off of that. Well, I was interested in our agriculture. You know, what happens to all of our fields? One third of our land is either planted in crops or it's used for pasturing animals. That's a lot of land. So I had to look at what happens to land that never saw fertilizer, like the farmlands of northern New England where I live, how they have come back so successfully to forest in the past few hundred years, since the farmers mostly moved on to longer growing seasons and deeper soils in Ohio territory and beyond. But also, what about what we're doing with fertilizers and pesticides? I was fortunate enough to find in England a research station north of London, Rothamsted Research, which was founded by the man who first patented fertilizers. And he was wise enough to set out test strips to look at, to see what every single additive, chemical additive, would do to different regimes of crops, monocultures, crop rotations, just leaving it in hay, or what would happen after you fertilize the hell out of something for a while, if you just left it fallow and let the woods come back in again. This experiment has been going on for 160 years, and it tells us enormous things about the ecosystem. It tells us enormous things about what will happen to land that we are spreading municipal sludge on, because heavy metals don't leach out of that stuff, and they last for many more years than Homo sapiens have had what we call civilization, or they will last. I looked at materials that we've made. Some of them are alarming. Plastics, except for the few that's been incinerated, they're all still here. And there's enormous quantities of them. And this has all happened since World War II. I mean, plastics were invented at the beginning of the 20th century, but they really weren't very common until they were released into the marketplace after World War II. And now we've released them into everything. And where do they go? Turns out that they really don't stay in our landfills the way that we think they do. Some of them do, but just like geology teaches us that everything ultimately erodes to the sea. Well, plastic weighs an awful lot less than a boulder or a mountain, and it all blows to the sea, and it's all floating out there, except wave action is breaking it up into smaller and smaller pieces, and it's being ingested by smaller and smaller organisms. They're finding jellyfish all over the place that are filled with brightly colored pieces of plastic. This is going to have an enormous impact on the future, whether we're here or not, because no microbe has evolved yet that can break this stuff down. Now, taking the long view, a plastics expert told me, oh, eventually it will happen. You know, they'll realize there's a feast out there. There's so much of it, and they'll figure out how to eat it. But in the meantime, it took millions of years for them to figure out how to eat lignin or cellulose, which is why coal mines are oftentimes entire tree trunks. You can see their grain in their, you know, the bark intact down there. They're just metamorphosed into coal. So that gave me pause. I looked at our radioactive waste, nuclear plants. I mean, what would happen if those got abandoned? I also look at our petrochemical plants. What was underneath that incredible jumble of pipes and tanks and cracking towers that runs from Houston to Galveston? And could it ever come back? Would it all go boom if suddenly we disappeared? Will it all go boom anyhow? I look at the most advanced nuclear plant in the world, Palo Verde. That's our newest one, outside of Phoenix. And then I also look at Chernobyl itself, which I mentioned before. And Chernobyl tells us a couple of interesting things, some disturbing things. I mean, one, it's kind of wonderful to see that nature has rushed in. The biodiversity around the reactor and the 30-kilometer radius evacuated zone is now much greater than the biodiversity outside that, where human beings are. But there is genetic damage. That's being documented now in the plants and animals. Some of it you can see. You can see funny pine needles growing in weird lengths, and you can see little spots of white on the birds. That's discouraging, because someday all of our nuclear plants, when they're abandoned, will turn into Chernobyls. Once that there's no power circulating the coolant around the cores will continue to heat up, and that coolant will evaporate, and they will either burst into flames, as Chernobyl did, or they will melt down, as Chernobyl also did. And we all know that one Chernobyl threw a lot of stuff out there in the ecosystem. But there's a population that they're now studying of voles, these little rodents, that is showing us something that's potentially encouraging. They're dying early because of the contamination, but they're also coming to maturity faster, and they're having bigger broods, which is nature's way, perhaps, of responding to a signal in the ecosystem and giving just a bigger pool of selection out there, with the possibility that maybe some of them will be born with more tolerance to radiation. And maybe that's the next way that evolution will take a little jog there. Now, that's not exactly my idea of what we should be doing, let everything just get radiated because nature will take care. But it also reinforced a point that I heard time and time and time again from the scientists that I talked to. Life is so resilient. It always finds a way. It finds a way to root in the little junctures of huge steel plates that form a bridge over the Hudson River, or even in Chernobyl. And Doug Irwin, who's a curator at the Smithsonian, one of our great extinction experts, said, he kind of shrugs. He said, this is going on. It's an extinction, all right. But, so if we die, big deal. I mean, every other species has gone extinct sooner or later. They all do. It's like, we all eventually die. What's the big deal here? He says, look at the Permian extinction. Like 90% of the species on the planet were wiped out then. 250 million years ago, and planet, there was a dieback, and then the planet sprung back, did okay. I mean, the age of dinosaurs, that was pretty impressive, right? And then some asteroid hits, and it throws something in the atmosphere that they couldn't contend with, so there's another big dieback, and then things just get going again, and eventually we get us. So, I turn to us, I look at not just some of these horror stories that we have left, but just some of the beautiful things. Our artwork, I mean, ceramics, they're basically chemically similar to fossils. They're going to last a long time if they don't get crushed. They'll get buried again. Someone will dig them up again. Bronze, that I talked to metallurgists and found out that bronze is probably the most resilient of all our metal alloys, which is great because my wife is a bronze sculptor and I thought that was very fitting, and she just thinks it's putting an awful lot of pressure on her to think a million years from now some critic from outer space is going to be going, you know. Well, ultimately, you know, I open this up even farther. And one of the most thrilling interviews for me in doing this book was with a man named John Lomborg, an artist who was asked by Carl Sagan to design the package that would show the sounds and the images of the Earth, both our fellow species here and some of our cultures, our great artwork, our wonderful music, from Chuck Berry to Mozart's Queen of the Night aria. And he appended it on the side of the Voyager spacecrafts that are now entering interstellar space, and off they go there. They're a billion years at least, but probably much longer that they'll last. And maybe someone, something, someday will find it. Maybe somehow they'll be able to read the designs that John and other semioticians, you know, symbols that they created, so these could be apprehended by something who had no idea what an Earthling was like. John also, by the way, has designed the symbols that will be the warning signs for the WIP plant, the isolation plant where we're burying low-grade nuclear waste in New Mexico. The EPA is required by law to warn the future 10,000 years in advance what's buried here. Don't dig here. And he says, you know, it's a noble attempt, anyhow, to try to talk to the future. But I find something really wonderful in realizing that our spirit and our creativity is something worth preserving and trying to immortalize. And so finally, you know, I turn to some of our spiritual leaders to ask them what they think. Many different religions, what would happen to the world without us? Would there even be a world without us? A lot of them don't believe there would be. One man was a Muslim cleric, a Sufi master from Istanbul, who at least said, well, the world was created for humans and it will end with humans, but while we are here, that doesn't mean that we should take it for granted. We must preserve it as a temple. That's what God wants us to do, and keep it as pure as possible. Well, that's a difference of opinion that I can live with. But most importantly, this book, The World Without Us, is not about what the world would be like without us people. It's about making us, clearing the decks so we can see it more clearly and think, well, isn't there a way that we can be part of it? And at the very end of this book, I offer a suggestion that just occurred to me naturally after everything that I've seen. It's very radical. And a lot of readers now have said to me, you know, if you would have told me that one right off the bat, I would have been, whoa. But now that I've read the whole thing, it makes so much sense. It has to do with the fact that it's not so much what we do. There's lots of things that we could do, and we're trying to do to lower our footprint, our impact, to shrink our footprint, to use less plastic. There's no reason that we need to go bag every individual vegetable in its own plastic bag. I mean, did your grandmother do that before World War II? Of course not. She carried the same bag back and forth to the marketplace. I mean, we've been sold a scam, or the grocery chains have been sold a scam, and we have to stop participating in that particular scam. And we also could and should wallpaper all of our rooftops with solar collectors. I mean, forget electricity if you want to. That's an expensive deal. Heating water with solar energy is cheap, and it could be done in any climate, and we could be doing it, and we should be doing it, and it should be a crime not to be doing it. But in the meantime, even if we did all those good things, the question comes up, is it not just what we're doing, but how many of us are doing it? So the suggestion I offer was just to pose another fantasy. This time, just suppose that tomorrow every family only had one child. Whoa, well, those draconian Chinese commies tried that. Didn't work real well. But actually, it worked somewhat. They should have brought down their birth rate. They still have lots of problems because there's lots of people. I could not get a population demographic institute in the United States to run the numbers for me on that. I tried to find the zero population growth people. They don't call themselves that anymore. They got scared away by people who politicize population growth for, well, various reasons. In Europe, I was able to find some demographers who said, that's an interesting idea, and they ran the numbers. Well, turns out, you know, at the end of the 20th century, we're at 1.6, it was the end of the 19th century, we're at 1.6 billion people, and now we're at 6.6 billion people, and by the middle of the century, we'll be at 9 billion people, which means growing even more food, taking out even more land from wilderness into agriculture, so there's less places for birds to land and their migratory patterns, etc. The figures showed that if we all just had one child now, within a century, we'd be back down to 1.6 billion people. Now, that's not going out and doing something really brutal by killing off one third, every third person or making big decisions. It's simply what a benign economy or corporation does when it wants to downsize to become leaner and healthier. Those are economic terms, right? But instead of handing out a bunch of pink slips, it just uses attrition. And then as people retire, it brings in fewer recruits to take their place. Well, I'm proposing that that's probably what we're going to have to do here. Because if we don't manage what's going to take, slow, gradual, humane reduction of the population on Earth, nature's going to do it for us. Every single species in the history of biology, when it's eaten itself out of house, home, and planet, it has had a population crash. Sometimes it's been totally fatal. The whole species is gone. But there will be a population crash. Now the question is, do we want to manage it ourselves humanely, or do we want nature to hand out a bunch of pink slips? Thank you very much.